Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Actually, the content today is mostly political, though our concerns are economic. The economic concern is, of course, raising money for KPFA, of which much more in a bit. To do that, we'll be offering as a premium a new book by Chase Madar, The Passion of Bradley Manning. Manning is, of course, the soldier who is accused of passing along 500,000 government documents, many, though not all of them, classified, to WikiLeaks. He's been in a military prison for the last 2 years. We'll talk with Chase Madar about Manning, the contents of the documents, the mania for classification, and how his harsh treatment is not all that extraordinary given the routine brutalities of the U.S. criminal justice system. Before that, some words in the news. I haven't been here for a couple of weeks. The U.S. economy continues in its slow, grinding recovery, but the Eurozone continues to unravel. Regular listeners may know that I've been wondering for some time what was motivating Germany in its uncompromisingly austere approach to the crisis on the continent's periphery. The German economy is very dependent on exports, and a big chunk of its exports go to the other 16 countries that use the euro, just over 40% of its exports to be precise. A quarter of that total, 11% of Germany's total exports, go to the so-called PIGS, the troubled countries of Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain. Exports to other EU countries, those that aren't part of the Eurozone, account for another 20% of German exports. Some analysts claim that Germany doesn't really care so much about the pigs because it's looking to China as its export destination of the future. But exports to China, whose economy, by the way, is slowing, account for less than 5% of German exports, well under half as much as the pigs, and less than German exports to Italy, only a bit more than its exports to Spain. So you might think that driving the pigs into the dirt might ultimately do some damage to Germany. And should the Eurozone break apart and the entire European economy implode, then Germany would really be in trouble. So what's Germany up to? I've always had a hard time believing the ideological explanations, that Germans are driven for reason of national character, whatever that is, to be tight-fisted, or anally retentive, if you prefer a different bodily metaphor, one with a long psychoanalytic pedigree. I'd always suspected there was some material interest at work, and I've finally discovered one thanks to a blog post by the Greek economist Yanis Varoufakis, a frequent guest on this show. In the old pre-Euro days, German capital hated the way in which countries of the periphery, like Italy, could devalue their currencies and undercut German exports. Germany has an enormous productivity advantage over its peripheral neighbors, meaning it has great competitive advantage over them. But if the Italians and the Greeks and the Spaniards could effectively put their entire national product on sale by devaluing their currencies, then Germany's advantage would be eroded. By bringing those countries into the same currency zone, that devaluation option would be foreclosed. It worked nicely for a while. German industry had a great boom. Productivity rose and a tight lid was kept on wages. In fact, under the social democratic government of Gerhard Schroeder, Germany created a whole new low-wage sector of part-time, non-union, contingent labor. There was no way the peripheral countries could match that, so they ran large trade deficits and borrowed the money from the surplus countries like Germany to keep it all going. But when the crisis struck, that flow of borrowed money stopped. Yet the Germans know no alternative to the strategy they've been using over the last decade. The last thing they want to do now is show mercy to potential competitors. But that intransigence could be suicidal if the Eurozone breaks up. If Germany wants to be a true imperial leader, it has to break out of this mercantilist way of thinking, its obsession with trade surpluses, and take a page from the managers of the post-World War II American empire. Spend a little, allow the Marshall Plan, and integrate a second tier of willing allies into the imperial system. That may raise up some competitors, but will strengthen the coherence of the whole system over the longer term. There are always third and fourth tier countries to exploit. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about Bradley Manning.
Thank you.
That was Son of War, the old Temptations Edwin Starr song, done by Laibach, the Slovenian ironists. War is good for GM, IBM, Newsweek, and CNN, and Siemens, as they say. My guest today is Chase Madar, a New York-based journalist and lawyer who is the author of The Passion of Bradley Manning, just out from OR Books, or sometimes OR Books. Bradley Manning is in a military prison, accused of, though yet untried for, having passed along hundreds of thousands of documents, many of them classified, to WikiLeaks. Though these include a massive quantity of unclassified State Department cables, there's a lot of classified info in there as well, though not as highly classified as the Pentagon papers from back in the Nixon years. The most famous of the trove that Manning is alleged to have released is the infamous collateral murder video, which shows the crew of an Apache helicopter gunship firing into a crowd of unarmed civilians, including several journalists and two children. I was re-watching a video the other day, and I was struck by how the U.S. military loves to appropriate Indian names. The Apache helicopter was codenamed Crazy Horse, and of course there's the Tomahawk cruise missile. How curious it is for an Imperial Army to appropriate the names of the people whom the founding imperialists expropriated and killed. Watching the video again also made me think about the men who saw cameras as AK-47s and lenses as RPGs. You could believe that they were monsters when they joined the military. Maybe a few, but not most. Most, I think, are just regular people who could be entirely decent in their previous civilian lives, but once placed in a hellish war zone, came to behave monstrously. And when their tours of duty are done, they return home, many of them broken and scarred for life. Okay, now here's Chase Madar, author of The Passion of Bradley Manning. In about half an hour, I'll tell you about how you can get a copy of that book by pledging to support KPFA. Welcome, Chase. First, let's just start by talking something about Bradley Manning. What's his background? Who is he?
Bradley Manning is a young man from the small town of Crescent, Oklahoma, north central Oklahoma. He enlisted in the U.S. Army in 2007, at the age of 22. And he is accused of being the source inside the U.S. military for WikiLeaks, for all their juiciest material, for the Afghan war logs, the Iraq war logs, the Guantanamo files, and about 500,000 State Department cables.
He didn't have an idyllic childhood in the heartland, did he?
Well, no, he didn't. And he grew up pretty middle class in this small town, but his parents and his community did not really give him much support in spite of the great promise that he showed as a young man. He won his school science fair 3 years running, even before his junior and senior years of high school. And he's someone who's had a lot of responsibility from a young age, took care of writing out the checks and paying the bills for his mother, who's not particularly good at that for various reasons. And from all accounts of reporters who have gone to Crescent, Oklahoma, his father was not a pleasant man to live with.
The word dick came up, right?
The word dick does come up.
Yes.
And I should also mention that Crescent, Oklahoma bears the distinction of being the gay whistleblower capital of the entire world. This is the town where Karen Silkwood worked in the plutonium processing plant, and where she was working until she disappeared under somewhat fishy circumstances on her way to a meeting with a New York Times reporter about to spill the beans about all kinds of safety violations in that plant.
And this part of Oklahoma, although it's, you know, perceived as a red state now, does have a long history of political insurgency.
There is a great history, a great radical history of Oklahoma. The red dirt there has fostered people like Woody Guthrie, like Karen Silkwood, and like Angie DeBoe, a great historian whom not that many people know about, a great truth teller and whistleblower who blew the whistle on how elite white families stole the land from the five quote-unquote civilized tribes, as they were called, back in the 1920s. And she was blacklisted, couldn't get a teaching job for years in Oklahoma, and is now seen as a patron saint of the intelligentsia there.
And Manning himself, sensitive, intelligent, gay, which he realized from an early age.
That's right.
Did not fit in the small town very well. What was his strategy for getting out?
Well, he joined the military, like a lot of people do. He's someone who really does have a deep sense of patriotism and a deep sense of obligation to the country and to our collective good. But he also wanted the GI Bill. He wanted to get a degree in physics and study that. He did not get the support he needed for university education either from his dad or from the state. So off to the army he went.
But initially he was not doing so well in the military.
No, he didn't. You know, Bradley Manning is someone who, I will never say that he's a screwed up guy, but he's someone who's really not cut out for the military, it seems. He was put in the discharge unit for people who are getting cycled out at Fort Leonard Wood in Missouri during basic training and had a hellish time there. But he was cycled back in because the military was so desperate in the year 2007 for people with his kind of IT skills.
So how did he end up with access to these secrets, which he eventually spilled?
Well, it's important to realize, to start with, that so many people, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, have some kind of security clearance. There are 4.2 million Americans with some kind of security clearance, and over 800,000 with a top secret security clearance. So it's not the great distinction or seal of any kind of approval that we think it is. It also calls into question the whole notion of secrets to begin with. Can something really be secret if 800,000 people have access to it? Why do we even have the system? How many of these things should have been classified to begin with? So, like many people, like virtually everyone working in Army intelligence, which is where Bradley Manning wound up at Forward Operating Base Hammer in the Ma'in Qata Desert of Iraq, he had access to these things.
And how did he end up from almost being thrown out to being in this, where he was and caused so much trouble?
Well, Bradley Manning enlisted during years of record lows in recruiting in 2007, and the military was desperate for people and desperate to shunt them wherever they were badly needed. And there was a huge need for people in the military with the kind of IT skills that Bradley Manning had, and had from a very young age, too.
And he was working in what sounded like a rather unpleasant environment.
Oh, yeah. From all reports, the skiffs in these military bases, which are themselves in the middle of nowhere without any kind of village or hamlet or even a hut in sight. A skiff is the secure room for confidential material and where all the computers with the classified hard drives are. And in theory, they are, you know, very well guarded. The security around them is very strict. But in reality, the skiff at Forward Operating Base Hammer, there was no security to speak of. People were going in and out with hard drives, activated hard drives, with CDs and DVDs, blank DVDs, all kinds of things coming out. And this is how Bradley Manning allegedly, and now famously, was able to get the WikiLeaks material out on what was labeled as a Lady Gaga CD.
And they had, some of the laptops had the passwords stuck on them with a Post-it.
That's right. There was no security whatsoever. And this isn't typical. Not all the skiffs. Many of the skiffs, these secured compartmentalized information facilities, I can't remember the acronym exactly, but they are, some of them are kept secure here in the United States, but many of them are not. And even though we feed unlimited budgetary resources to intelligence and to our surveillance industry, a lot of it is shockingly unprofessional, as many reporters and investigators have found.
He's what? He's been in detention for 2 years now without a trial.
Very close to 2 years.
Without a trial.
Without his court-martial. It's scheduled right now for late September, although there's a high chance it will be postponed further.
And he spent much of that time in solitary?
He spent the first 9 months in solitary.
Which is a miserable regimen. To describe what his day was like.
Well, the most shocking thing is that he had to answer every 5 minutes of his waking hours to the question of a guard, "Are you okay?" which would drive anyone crazy, I think, very quickly.
Not allowed to nap during the day.
Not allowed to nap. Not allowed to do push-ups or sit-ups, just given 1 hour a day where he's allowed to run around in a larger room, again by himself. Fed to the gills with antidepressants. For the last month or so of a solitary, he was stripped of his clothes, stripped of his eyeglasses even, because he had said something that gave offense to the guards there. And it's important to note that none of this was for medical reasons. Whenever people...
The pretext was he was a suicide risk?
The pretext was that this was for his own good, of course, that he was a suicide risk.
Which I believe the president repeated.
And the president did mouth that solemnly at some press conference. But even the Quantico Marine Corps Briggs' own psychiatrist found time and time again that there was no medical need whatsoever for this treatment. And that finding was duplicated by the psychiatrist brought in by the defense attorney. So this kind of treatment, it resembles very closely the way that political dissidents were treated in the old Soviet Union, put in psikhushkas, they were called, psychiatric prisons where they were fed to the gills with psychoactive drugs. And the assumption is that if you disagree with the state, if you're a political dissident, then you must be wrong in the head somehow. Of course, I don't have to go as far as the Soviet Union to find parallels in similar cases, because there are between 70 and 100,000 Americans in solitary confinement, long-term solitary confinement in our state and federal prisons. Many of them are treated in a very similar way. This should be a national scandal. Solitary confinement is properly viewed as torture, and international law gets closer and closer every year to acknowledging that. Our own Supreme Court came very close in 1890 to outlawing the practice altogether.
I want to return to the ordinariness of this a little later, but now what kind of environment is he in now?
He's in a medium security prison population at Fort Leavenworth in Kansas.
And awaiting trial.
Awaiting his court-martial.
Which will be under military rules.
That's right. And I would like to say that that is a huge scandal, but I think even if his trial were to take place in a federal civilian court, you'd have the same outcome. Our federal courts are also capable of losing their minds and giving down harsh draconian sentences to people who have transgressed in very minimal ways, as we've seen especially in the past 10 years. Out of the top 10 injustices in this case, I think court procedure is not even in that list.
Well, I would guess that the chances are 99% that he's going to be found guilty and put away for a very long time.
Oh, I think you give him better odds than I do. I don't think there's any doubt that this young man is going to be convicted and sentenced to at least 50 years, and that is not a good thing.
And just noting also the context of this, you point out a couple times that the Obama administration has initiated more prosecutions of leakers under the Espionage Act than all previous administrations combined.
In fact, the Obama administration has launched more than twice as many prosecutions based on the Espionage Act of 1917 against domestic leakers as all previous presidents combined.
And some of these things are rather, obviously what Bradley Manning is alleged to have done is fairly significant, but a lot of these prosecutions look fairly trivial.
Oh, for sure. The Tom Drake prosecution, for instance, that crumpled on reality, on impact with reality, with a real judge, with the prospect of a real trial, and the Department of Justice dropped all of the serious charges just a couple days before the main trial action was to begin, which is just a shocking way to do things. They ruined the guy's life, even though they really had nothing on him.
And, of course, if this had been the Bush administration, there would be wails and complaints.
There would be all kinds of keening and wailing about this, but Barack Obama, unfortunately, gets a pass.
I'm speaking with Chase Madar, who is the author of The Passion of Bradley Manning, is just out from OR Books. Okay, let's talk about the contents of what Bradley Manning is alleged to have leaked. The most famous thing, of course, is the video, and I would guess that most listeners have seen the video, but remind us of its contents.
The Collateral Murder video, which is easily available at collateralmurder.com, shows it's the gunsight view from an Apache helicopter piloted by Americans who are occupying Iraq, gunning down a crowd of mostly civilians on a July day in 2007. And the death toll is over a dozen. A van comes in to pick up the wounded and take them to safety and for treatment, and the helicopter opens fire on the van as well, killing the driver and wounding a couple of small children who are inside. Now, this is a shocking video. Different people, of course, make different things of it. There's debate about whether or not this is legal. I find that whole debate almost inconsequential. You can see with your own eyes what happens. There were a couple...
But it isn't all probability legal under the laws of war.
Yeah, I believe so. And I know that's very...
And you're a lawyer.
And I am a lawyer. And it's shocking to think that this might be legal, but I think many liberal-minded people need to realize that the laws of war do not exist for the protection of civilians. Their primary function is to protect the privileges of combatants. and to guarantee their immunity if they do kill civilians. Collateral damage, killing civilians, is not outlawed under any stretch of the imagination by the laws of armed conflict. It is merely regulated, and there's a vague attempt to limit it, but these laws are very flexible in the hands of a great military power.
Nonetheless, legal or not, it's horrific to watch.
Absolutely. To say that this act is legal is not a defense of the act. It's clearly an atrocity, but it is an indictment of the laws of armed conflict as we know them.
But also, as far as we know, this was an entirely routine activity. This stuff goes on all the time.
Absolutely. There's nothing, I think, particularly out of the ordinary. We know there's been a tremendous civilian death toll from our invasion and occupation of Iraq, and this is just a glimpse of it.
And some of Bradley Manning's colleagues in that the intelligence room were watching videos, what they call war porn, right?
Yeah, according to reports from soldiers who were working in this SCIF, one way to pass the time, and there were terrible long hours, people working 12-hour shifts day after day in the middle of the desert with really not much to do, was to watch what they called war porn, watch these gun sight angle videos, and just to have them screening, and the view from predator drones, too, usually not opening fire on people, but that was the kind of mesmerizing backdrop in this incredibly boring world of work.
And so far, the quantity of outrage expressed over this seems to be tilted in favor of the fact that it was released.
Oh, absolutely. Instead of being shocked at the sight of what our occupation and our conquest of Iraq was really all about, there's been much more outrage that this thing was leaked and that this somehow is a PR problem for us. It's not a PR problem. It's a reality problem for us.
And why did Bradley Manning allegedly leak this? What led him to this pass?
Yeah, so much has been written about Bradley Manning's motives. People have ascribed all kinds of motives to him. He did it because he was bitter, because he's gay, because he had a less than ideal childhood. I think all of this is nonsense. The main source of information we have about Bradley Manning's time in the military is this series of chat logs that go on for 5 days between Manning himself and the informant who turned him in, Adrian Lamo, a very famous computer hacker for those people who follow such things, who turned police informant after just a couple of days. And Bradley Manning is very clear in his conversations about why he did this. He thinks people need to see the truth. People need to have information without which you can't make well-informed decisions. It's really as simple as that. Now, Bradley Manning had been tasked to look into the arrest by Iraqi authorities of a group of nonviolent civilian protesters in Iraq. The protesters had been handing out a pamphlet called Where Does the Money Go? Looking into the incredible corruption in the Iraqi government. And for this horrible offense, they were hauled off and detained by the Iraqi authorities. Now, this gave Bradley Manning some real trouble to his conscience, because he very well knew, like a great many other Americans in Iraq knew, that the practice of torture by the Iraqi authorities is still routine. Even after the U.S. invasion, the habit of torture by the Iraqi federal police and by the Iraqi military has continued unabated, without much change from the days of Saddam Hussein. And when Bradley Manning brought this up the chain of command to his superior's attention,
which he was supposed to do,
and which he did properly, according to these chat logs, Manning was told to just shut up and get back to work helping the Iraqi authorities round up more people.
You quote a lot of these chat logs, and he comes off as an extremely thoughtful, sophisticated, well-read for his age, guy. He made his decision on the basis of some like serious political philosophical precepts. He was not just some bitter guy seeking revenge, as he's been portrayed in some circles.
Absolutely not. You read the chat logs, there's nothing, you read nothing about Bradley Manning wanting to take revenge on the military or wanting to tear the house down. Not at all. He is simply saying that people in America need to know what this occupation is all about. Bradley Manning's problem is that he thought Operation Iraqi Freedom really would be about Iraqi freedom. He really thought that the mission there would be to help install liberal democracy, human rights, things like that. But once he saw the truth, he reacted against it.
And then the contents of the rest of the WikiLeaks, your review, the major points of that, remind us of what some of the important contents of what was revealed.
Oh, very quickly, we see an unvarnished, unprocessed view of both the Iraq War and the Afghan War. Raw field reports about civilians getting killed at checkpoints, night raids gone wrong where soldiers in the occupying force kill civilians, for instance. Extensive records of how torture is still being conducted by the Iraqi authorities under the nose of American soldiers. That was not supposed to happen. In the Guantanamo files, we see the record of failure there. We get the real scoop on a lot of the detainees, over 600 of whom have been released since they were in prison there, most of them by Bush and Cheney, but some by Obama. And we see that most of them were not high-powered terrorists. They were not the worst of the worst. They were, many of them were serious Muslims and involved in their own civil conflicts in that part of the world, but they were not a threat to the United States. And last, we see in the State Department cables, over half of which, by the way, are not classified in any way, the real goings-on of American statecraft. You see the incredible influence of corporate lobbies informing American policy and statecraft.
You mentioned specifically the drug companies. Like they practically run the State Department's policy.
They run the State Department's law for intellectual property and for patent law. And you also see in Haiti, there are particularly striking logs. And The Nation magazine did a terrific series analyzing the Haiti leaks, but how American producers like Haynes and Fruit of the Loom were successfully able to pressure the Haitian government through the State Department to keep the minimum wage down in the poorest country in the hemisphere. It's pretty disgusting.
My reaction when I first read a lot of this stuff was, you know, I kind of knew this all along. But it was nice to see it confirmed. I mean, one always had the suspicions this is precisely what was going on. But there it is in black and white. The other thing that really impressed me was that a lot of the diplomats were fairly sophisticated analysts. They're you know, writing some interesting stuff, and they're not yahoos.
Oh, sure. I mean, most of the diplomatic cables are by no means an embarrassment to America's diplomatic corps. They come off looking pretty smart and, as you say, like savvy analysts who know what's going on.
So, yeah, this notion that Washington just doesn't know is a hard one to sustain.
Oh, absolutely.
I'm speaking with Chase Madar, who is the author of The Passion of Bradley Manning, just out from OR Books. So the reaction around the world to the WikiLeaks cables has been quite profound. I mean, even if they didn't make much of a dent here, they certainly had a lot of effect abroad, such as...
Well, they have had a greater impact abroad. I don't want to overstate the role of the WikiLeaks disclosures in the Tunisian uprising and revolution, but I don't think you can tell the story of that great uprising against dictatorial rule without mentioning WikiLeaks, because... The assessments by American diplomats in Tunisia of how weak and how corrupt the Ben Ali government was played a significant role in energizing people, in confirming what they already suspected. And if you look at other countries, in the Dominican Republic, the candid assessments of corruption in that government by our diplomats has spurred reforms and a real cleanup there. And I think we have yet to see the real results. I've talked to Haitian Americans and members of the Haitian diaspora who are thrilled to know the real scoop on America's policy towards Haiti.
But of course the reaction of the American government was ballistic.
Well, ballistic. And it's with every wave of released documents, there's a two-step dance. The first step is a ballistic reaction talking about how this is causing diplomatic Armageddon, how these people, WikiLeaks, have blood on their hands, and then followed usually a week or so later, once real journalists start investigating these claims, with a quiet retraction, a quiet admission that there's actually no evidence that you can tie a single casualty, military or civilian, to the WikiLeaks disclosures, and a rather shamefaced admission that, well, maybe it's not as dire as all that.
And there's a lot of worry, including coming from some liberals, that revealing the names of informants was going to cause their death.
Oh, well, this is just ridiculous, too. I mean, I think these liberals are just acting like concern trolls. the real journalists from Associated Press and the Christian Science Monitor who followed up and sought out these activists around the world who are named in the unredacted State Department logs found that these sources and these activists were utterly shocked to find that any record had ever been made of their conversation. They were mostly creeped out that it had been made somehow secret or confidential. They did it pretty openly. They did not find anyone who was getting punished for it. I think it's very important to note that we are at zero risk of being too transparent as a government, as a society. Washington every year classifies 77 million documents. Only last year did we finish declassifying material from the War of 1812. The idea that WikiLeaks is putting us on a slippery slope to some crazy anarchy of total transparency is absolute fantasy. It's fiction, and people should know better. What the response of WikiLeaks and whistleblowers like allegedly Bradley Manning, it's a very pragmatic response. It's a defensive response to just get a little bit of partial transparency. It's like shining a flashlight in a dark room, because we have seen very clearly in the past 10 years that when we don't have the information we need and we make important decisions based on faulty information or government secrecy and distortion, we do some pretty foolish things with catastrophic consequences, like invading Iraq, for instance.
77 million, that's an enormous number of documents. And how many things are there of the sensitivity of the nuclear launch codes? I mean, what are they doing with all that classification?
What are they doing? They're doing nothing with it except holding it secret. And even to pry documents and information that is clearly not a national security risk still takes armies of lawyers and even well-funded advocacy groups like, say, the ACLU still have a really hard time and only partial success in getting important information out of the government. Now, I'm not for total transparency. I doubt anyone is. I bet Julian Assange, even after his fourth whiskey, would say that he's for total transparency. Of course, nuclear launch codes should be secret. But we are so far from classifying just what needs to be secret. Again, classifying 77 million documents a year, it is plainly a problem of immense proportions.
But, of course, leaking is part of the official culture of Washington. You quote William Daley saying, organized leaking is okay. He just doesn't like the disorganized kind.
Oh, for sure. Rahm Emanuel was a virtuoso leaker, and this has been known for years. I mean, there are gastronomical guides to all the different kinds of leaks that take place routinely in Washington. Just last January, we had somebody, an unnamed official, leak the national intelligence estimate on Afghanistan to the Washington Post and the New York Times. There was no scandal. There was no threat of investigation. I'm not saying there should have been either. We need this kind of information. But leaks of top secret material are a routine occurrence by elite officials, and they do so with impunity.
Well, that's the important part. These are elite officials who have an agenda, and they represent powerful interests or powerful interest groups. And the disorganized kind of leaking that Bradley Manning represents is a total different story.
It's a different story. Our laws on national security and information security, they do not apply to elite officials, to Washington elites, but they come down with the force of a thunderbolt on people like Bradley Manning. What's good for the private is not good for the general or for the cabinet secretary.
And what kinds of people is Obama prosecuting?
Obama is prosecuting people who have mildly embarrassed some part of the National Security Agency. It has nothing to do with harm they've caused, but look at Kiriakou, the former CIA agent who's written about torture and went to the media where the identity of one other CIA agent who was involved in torture became apparent. The real harm to our national interests is absolutely minimal. I think it's purely speculative. But he is the subject of a harsh prosecution, and he may end up doing time in prison. Or then again, it could wind up like the whistleblower prosecution of Thomas Drake, where as soon as the charges came into contact with actual daylight and with actual judge, they fell apart.
But the guy had to endure years of hell.
Years of hell ruined his career, and it killed him financially as well.
Speaking of Chase Madar, author of The Passion of Bradley Manning from OR Books. Now, you make I think a very important point, though, in the book that the treatment of Bradley Manning is outrageous, but really not so much at odds with what goes on every day in our criminal justice system.
You know, I would like to join the chorus of liberals who say that the treatment of Bradley Manning, nearly 2 years of pretrial detention, the first 9 months in strictest solitary confinement, is some kind of anomaly, some kind of affront to American values, some kind of shocking aberration. Sad truth is, it really isn't. We have between 70 and 100,000 Americans in long-term solitary confinement today. It is a routine practice. They have not been convicted of exotic national security crimes, but they are being driven slowly insane. That is normal. It is a normal part of our penal landscape. And even pretrial solitary confinement, although it's not usual, it's not common, it happens fairly often without much scandal. And it's important that we know this about how our everyday, quote-unquote, normal penal justice system works at home. Many people overall have tried to look at the war on terror as some horrible exception to American values and to our practices at home. This gets good rhetorical traction, and you can see why advocacy groups like the ACLU do this. I don't think, however, it's accurate. There are many intellectuals, most of whom happen to be African American, which is significant, who see the war on terror as just exporting our everyday penal practices to more visible, more exotic forums. And that's all we're doing. We're exporting the harshness of our day-to-day system to Abu Ghraib, to Bagram prison in Afghanistan, and to Guantanamo.
Well, and as you point out, Gitmo is really not all that different from a supermax in the U.S.
No, it's the exact same architecture. I think, again, I'm not defending Guantanamo. I think the whole system should be shut down. But the problem there right now, it's not one of people being tortured. I think that prison complex there probably lives up to the Geneva Conventions on the treatment of combatants better than most of our domestic prisons would.
You quote a lawyer as saying he would probably advise a client to take 3 years in Gitmo over 10 years in a domestic supermax.
Yes, that's the great Josh Dreitel, one of the most experienced and savviest criminal defense lawyers you'll find.
The Gitmo itself was modeled in a prison in Indiana?
In Terre Haute, Indiana, the supermax there.
Gitmo gets most of the attention, but Bagram is even bigger and more outrageous.
That's right. And because it operates much farther away geographically, it gets a bit of a free pass. It's much harder to send a journalist there, to send NGO advocates there to look into that horrible prison and what's going on there.
So, returning to the topic of Bradley Manning, really, and we can talk about what citizens can do, but it does seem... We seem kind of powerless, too.
It's certainly a long-term project, and we need to educate ourselves and others that we have a real crisis in government secrecy. Our real threat to national security and to a free society, it's not whistleblowers, it's not WikiLeaks, it's classifying 77 million documents a year. We cannot remain free if we have that level of extreme government secrecy. And the wages in blood and money, I know you're not supposed to talk about, you know, the cost in blood and money as a good liberal, but this has cost us a great deal. And it has cost the world, the people of Iraq and Afghanistan, even more when we make foolish decisions with catastrophic consequences because we were not well informed.
And let's stop here, because what follows is about 20 minutes of begging for money for KPFA. Which is certainly necessary to keep KPFA on the air, but not something I think that most listeners to the podcast want to hear. If you do like this podcast and want to keep it coming, then please consider giving some money to KPFA. Keep this more than 60-year-old experiment in community broadcasting alive. To do so, visit KPFA on the web at kpfa.org, where you can pledge securely. There are all kinds of premiums you can choose from. kpfa.org. Okay, that's it for me, Doug Henwood. It's not even proper to say till next week, because who knows what time you're hearing this. Bye.